KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Which was expected. So we continue to just advise people leave as early as you possibly can and just expect there to be delays out there.
The collapse has cut off the main route between Seattle and Canada, and it also sent tons of concrete and steel into the river. Authorities say all three people that were rescued only had minor injuries. The semi-truck driver is cooperating with police. State officials say the bridge was built in 1955 and was old and in constant need of maintenance. I-5 near Mount Vernon remains closed for the foreseeable future. We'll get fresh updates from WashDOT in just a few minutes on weekday. If you planned on doing any long drives this Memorial Day weekend, be aware that gas prices have spiked in Western Washington. Jennifer Cook is a spokesperson for AAA Washington. She says prices have gone up 35 cents in the past month because of production issues at fuel refineries in Ferndale and Anacortes.
Refineries tend to slow their production in that February, March, April timeframe so that they can switch from winter fuel blends to summer fuel blends. And there was a couple snags this time. And so because our supplies were low and when they hit those snags, it impacted gas prices more than it typically does.
AAA says gas was $4 a gallon in Washington yesterday, the eighth highest in the country. This is KUOW News. I'm Jamala Henderson.
Support for KUOW comes from Clipper Vacations Daily Departures to Victoria, B.C.
52 and overcast in the University District. We're expecting a high today of 59 degrees with a chance of showers. Support for NPR comes from Wix.com, enabling over 30 million local businesses to create customized websites with the Wix website builder at Wix.com. I'm Rob Wood. What's prompting some behaviors to be labeled now as mental illnesses? Warren Olney takes a closer look at the new psychiatric manual, the DSM-5, on To the Point this morning at 11. 94.9 KUOW, it's 9:06.
From 94.9, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. An Interstate 5 bridge over the Skagit River at Mount Vernon collapsed last night, as you have been hearing all morning. According to eyewitnesses, the semi-truck carrying an oversized load hit one of the bridge's beams, and that triggered the collapse. Two vehicles were dumped into the water, but none of the three people who went along with those vehicles was killed. We're going to hear more about the bridge itself and the state of bridge inspection later this hour on Weekday. Now we turn to Travis Phelps. He's a spokesperson for the Washington State Department of Transportation. And Travis, thanks for being with us today.
Hey, my pleasure.
Can you clarify again exactly what this semi-truck hit on the bridge that triggered the collapse?
Yeah, so this bridge is basically created with a series of steel trusses. It's kind of an old-school looking bridge. And a vehicle carrying an over-height load struck the bridge in several critical areas, causing one span of the bridge to fall into the water.
Hmm. I understand the bridge was inspected twice last year. It wasn't on a watch list, so it wasn't in danger of falling. But was this something inherent to the bridge design?
This could happen to any new, even a new bridge. This isn't a design issue per se. If you have a brand new bridge, you strike it at freeway speeds with a multi-ton object, you're going to see a catastrophic failure. Just like we saw on I-5 in Skagit County.
What was destroyed and what remains standing?
We had about a 100-foot section of the bridge drop into the water. It's probably, just kind of my rough guess, probably about close to a third of the bridge or so. The rest of it remains standing. It's unclear at this point if the rest of the bridge could be used to replace I-5 in the future.
So I understand that the National Transportation Safety Board has triggered an investigation into this accident. How does that impact going forth with reconstruction?
Well, we want to make sure we know everything, all the details that went into this horrific collision. We're working together with the Washington State Patrol and the National Transportation Safety Board to put those details together. And, we all might learn something from this. It could tell us what we already know. But the fact is we're going to investigate this top to bottom. We're not taking this incident lightly at all.
How many vehicles a day travel over this bridge?
You're averaging close to 70,000, give or take.
And are there official detour routes for them, or are they just on their own to look at a map and travel through Skagit County?
We do have some official detour routes. Highway 9 is a great alternate route. You've got Highway 20 and 531 as well. However, those cannot carry that the same amount of traffic as I-5. So you're going to be having to prepare for significant congestion, especially as we go to the holiday weekend.
I know that the governor was up in Mount Vernon yesterday. Is that where you are, by the way?
No, I'm actually in Seattle right now,
okay.
The Emergency Operations Center.
I know that the governor traveled up to Mount Vernon, and he's counseling patients. I've seen people talking about repairs within weeks, not months. But essentially, we're talking about the entire summer travel season, I-5 will be impassable at Mount Vernon?
It's a little too soon to tell. We need to make sure we complete the investigation to the highest level possible. We're already working with emergency plans to replace the bridge as soon as possible. But, this is going to be a long-term issue. This isn't something that's going to go away in a couple of weeks. This could be something that's hanging around with us for a while. But exact time frame, too soon to tell.
I-5 has been closed before. In Lewis County, there was flooding that closed the highway in 2007 and 2009. What did you learn from that at WSDOT that is being applied to this particular closure?
Well, it's all about getting information out to folks and helping them understand how to get from point A to point B. Obviously, I-5 carries a lot of freight, so we're looking at the freight corridor between Canada and Oregon. Making sure we're talking back and forth with the truckers who use that route. We're also talking to the different countries. We're doing some outreach up into Canada, Vancouver, BC. A lot of folks coming down for Sasquatch Festival this weekend. So we're expanding our horizons, going way outside the box, the folks we normally communicate with. More information, the merrier.
And where should travelers go for information about traffic or detours or diversions?
We have a special page called the What's Happening Now page on the WSDOT website. If you go to the WSDOT website, it's in the big red box. Just go ahead and click on that. It'll give you detour information and everything you need to know.
Travis, thanks for taking time to talk to us this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Travis Phelps is a spokesperson for the Washington State Department of Transportation, joined us from the Seattle Transportation Center. And joining us now is Jill Budrow, who is the mayor of Mount Vernon. And Mayor, thank you for taking time to talk to us today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for allowing me to be on the show.
Oh, I imagine that your citizenry is not just totally worried but happy that people are safe, but wondering how all this traffic that we're talking about is going to impact the city itself. And so how are you planning to cope with this?
You know, you bet. We really aren't sure what's going to happen, and so we're doing our very best to think ahead long-term and short-term, trying to plan some routes, especially for our local traffic, but also in the long-term, how are those going to work? So we're doing our best to make those plans now.
We're hearing, upwards of 70,000 cars and trucks a day take this route. The city of Mount Vernon can't handle anything near that, can it?
You know, that would be a significant issue for us. We've got our busiest intersection in town handles about 40,000 cars a day. So, adding significantly more is going to be an issue. So, like I said, we're really working on the three different exits, that exit I-5 into Mount Vernon, and how we can really guide people around this closure.
Are there, for your citizens themselves, there's other ways across the Skagit River from the east to the west in town? Does this impact any kind of local traffic for you, just in terms of folks getting to work?
Our folks here in town, there's lots of different routes that they can take to avoid our College Way River intersection area. So we're hoping that our folks will go around the long way, but we do have a route that just opened, the LaVenture-Anderson connection, that's going to help us quite a bit.
Now, Mayor Budrow, where were you yesterday evening?
You know, I was had a city function right at 7 o'clock, and I was sitting down with a friend to catch up and chat when we got some texts. So, I left there immediately and came down to our police department and was tried to be as helpful as possible.
We've heard about other bridge collapses in other parts of the country, and most recently we've been hearing about the devastation of the tornado. So I suppose when you weigh what happened in your town with what happened in other places, nobody died. And we're just looking at a horrible infrastructure problem, but no loss of life.
You know, you're right. I think for several hours there, it was just a kind of a horrifying scene. And then you breathe a sigh of relief that there weren't any fatalities. And it's really a miracle, I think. And now we're dealing with some major inconveniences. But, in the long, in the bigger picture, we are grateful that there was no loss of life.
What's the biggest concern that you're hearing from your merchants in Mount Vernon?
Yeah, it's going to be the traffic impacts and how are people going to come. We are hoping that we can figure out a way to make this work so that we're not losing folks who are interested in being here in the city of Mount Vernon. But there is a lot of concern and a lot of uncertainty. So we want folks to be really patient with us. We're just doing our best. We'll adjust things as we need to do that. But we want to make things as smooth as we can with what we have to deal with.
Well, Mayor Boudreaux, thank you for taking a few minutes to talk with us, and good luck.
Oh, thank you so much.
Jill Boudreaux is the mayor of Mount Vernon, Washington. A little later this hour, we're going to be talking with somebody about the bridge itself and these kind of bridges that are called fracture critical structures and how that might have contributed to last night's accident. This is Weekday on KUOW.
KUOW, it's 9:15.
Support for KUOW comes from North Seattle Community College, now offering a Bachelor of Applied Science degree in International Business, preparing students for careers in global marketing, finance, trade, and commerce. Enrolling now for fall quarter. More at northseattle.edu/BAS.
It's 52 degrees and overcast this morning in Seattle's University District. It's going to be mostly cloudy for the rest of the day. We're looking at about a 40% chance of showers today, with a high of about 59 degrees. Tonight will be cloudy with some rain possible, a low around 48. And to kick off our Memorial Day weekend tomorrow, it's going to be mostly cloudy with a slight chance of some more rain. We'll have a high of about 63 degrees.
KUOW would like to thank Microsoft and its employees, the Real Networks Foundation, the Kongsgaard Goldman Foundation, the Cape Flattery Foundation, and our other corporate and private foundation contributors for their support of public radio and their commitment to building a vibrant community through corporate contributions and foundation grants.
I'm Rob Wood. Tavis Smiley talks with singer-songwriter Amy Grant about her career and the stories behind her first album in a decade this afternoon in the 1 o'clock hour here on 94.9 KUOW.
From KUOW, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. We've inaugurated a new Friday segment. We're looking at the news from the world of science and technology. And today we welcome Alan Boyle into the studio. He's science editor for NBC News Digital. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Marcy.
First, we have to turn your microphone on, make
sure
it works. There you are.
Testing.
There you go. Live radio. So I wanted to talk a little bit about tornadoes. Residents of Moore, Oklahoma are cleaning up from the tornado. And with a few days hindsight, folks are starting to look at the climate science, and we keep hearing about this thing called Tornado Alley that Moore is apparently in the middle of. What is Tornado Alley, and what does it mean for what we saw this week?
Well, Tornado Alley is geographically placed so that it's a perfect place for tornadoes to develop. You've got the Rocky Mountains holding back air from coming over from the west, and then you've got frigid air coming down from the Arctic, and you've got warm air coming up from the Gulf. And so unfortunately for the residents, it's a perfect place in the springtime for these tornadoes to develop.
That's, I understand. Yeah, sorry. I understand that it's a little bit late this year, the tornado season. People were thinking they were going to get off easy.
Yeah, it ranges. Just almost exactly a year or two ago, we had a similar outbreak of these things. And so it's not a big deal if it's a little late or early.
Another question that people are asking has to do with the very cold, wet winter and climate change. Does changing climate, warming temperatures have anything to do with the severity of what we saw?
Right. In fact, the tornado season was a little quieter in the early part, in part because of the relatively cold spring in the area. And so that's why people were thinking they were going to get off with an easy season. And then the weather took a little bit of a change, and then that's when more happened.
But essentially, a tornado forms because
two air masses, that one cold, one hot collide.
Right, right. And there are lots of mysteries still around tornadoes. You mentioned climate change, that tornadoes are very hard things to model. They're small phenomena. And so it's hard for current day climate models to really figure out exactly what's going on. So it's a fascinating subject for meteorologists to dig into.
Now, we're going to go from what was happening in the Oklahoma Panhandle, Texas Panhandle area, up to space. You've got a photo on your MSNBC website of a guy holding a pizza. this is NASA's new exploration, the brave new world of food. Is it a real pizza? And are we talking about feeding pizza to astronauts?
This has been a big week for space food. Actually, Chris Hadfield, who is the Canadian astronaut who turned into a superstar because of his videos, participated in an experiment with the folks from MythBusters. And what you're seeing in that picture is actually not a pizza. It's sort of a taco burrito-y type of thing. What they did is that they took food that was available on the space station and tried to make something that was more palatable. That's always a big thing for astronauts, is that you get into food boredom pretty quickly.
I guess, but it's coming out of some kind of a printer?
Well, that's what they want to do, and the quest to build a 3D printer for food in space is going to be a years-long exercise, I'm afraid.
Well, they're not actually printing the food. What are they? I mean, is it like an extruded food substance?
3D printing is, as you know, a big thing nowadays. Everything is being 3D printed. If you go to the NBCNews.com website, you'll probably find a story every day about some new thing that they're doing in a 3D printer. For example, there was a case of a young boy whose throat they operated on, and they put in a splint that was printed on a 3D printer.
Well, I can understand that, because that's not something that you eat. So I'm still sort of a little bit confused about how you make something how is it food?
It's a bizarre experiment, and there's a company in Texas that received a $125,000 grant from NASA in order to develop a 3D food printer. And so you can extrude plastic through a 3D food printer, you can extrude metal, and what they want to do is that they want to take the raw materials for food, starch, fat, protein, that sort of thing, combine it with flavorings in sort of an inkjet printer, and so you print out this generic food that takes on the taste of whatever you want it to be. It can be a taco, it can be a pizza, whatever. And so they're going to be studying this for the next 6 months and trying to come up with the first components for a 3D printer for space food.
Yum. Alan Boyle is a science editor for NBC News Digital. There's another bigger food-related space experiment going on. This is in Hawaii. There are six, as I understand, gastronauts who are in some kind of metal container.
This is something that I'll be writing about, and you'll see it on the NBCNews.com website over the weekend, that there's an experiment in Hawaii called High Seas. That's an acronym, you know, for space exploration, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But the point is that they want to see what kind of food works best for the dynamics of a group on a long-term space mission. And so is it better just to have, you know, just add water and heat type of meals, or is it better for the crew to be involved in actually creating a meal as you would at home? And so that's what they're doing. They're testing both approaches. And it came in for a little bit of criticism from Rand Paul, who said, can you believe that they're paying these people to make pizzas on Mars? But it's a serious experiment. And in fact, NASA is going to be extending this experiment for another three years. They're not going to spend 3 years in this habitat, but but eventually they'll get to the point where they're cooped up in this habitat for a year at a time and seeing if they can stand the food.
Wow. Well, you mentioned Mars, and over, if as I understand it, more than 78,000 people have signed up for their golden opportunity for a one-way trip to Mars?
Oh, yeah. Everybody kind of wonders where people's heads are at when they're signing up for this thing. And so we talked with three people who signed up, including David Brin. And science fiction fans will know that this is the guy who wrote The Postman, Earth. There's a new book called Existence. And so he knows more than most people what's going to be involved in this. I don't think that he's quite ready to sell all his stuff and go to Mars, but he's interested in the whole idea of doing this.
Who's going to send them to Mars?
There's a Dutch venture called Mars One that is trying to raise this money. They figure it's going to cost $6 billion, and they're going to try to raise it through reality TV shows. They're going to have a Survivor-type show to test these people and see which people are going to be best suited to go to Mars. And so maybe NPR could get in on this, you know, pledge for your favorite candidate.
But they're only going one way.
Yeah. The idea is that if you're going to settle Mars, just as people settled America a few centuries ago, they've got to go and do it. And it saves on the cost of bringing them back and the logistics of bringing them back. The issue is you have to build a colony there.
Oh, okay. They're not just going to dump them out and they die.
Well, I hope not.
Wow. I understand the finalists, not all 78,000 people are competing. they're picking the finalists in August and then...
No, it's actually going to be a years-long process that they're going to be having people sign up through August, and then they take all these people, and then there's supposed to be a whole routine of TV shows on the national level, the international level. It's like American Idol for astronauts. And then in 2022, they're going to send up the first crew of four. That's the idea. And then they'll settle, and then hopefully more people will follow after that.
Well, I know that people are talking about ways to colonize space. I suppose this is, you know, the Kickstarter version of
exactly.
that, of doing that.
Yes.
Alan Boyle is science editor for NBC News Digital. Find his work at MSNBC.com. Thank you for everything from extruded pizza explanations.
We cover it all, Marcy.
You cover it all in the news. Thanks for coming in today.
Thank you.
This is Weekday. From KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. The I-5 bridge that collapsed near Mount Vernon last night was designated as a fracture critical bridge by a federal bridge listing. So what does that mean? And how did that contribute to what happened when the semi-truck hit the bridge last night? Joining us now is Larry Eel. He's publisher and editor of TransportationIssuesDaily.com, a former WashDOT employee. Hello, Larry. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So what does that mean, fracture critical bridge?
Well, it basically means if you take out one section of the bridge structure, the rest of it is likely to fail. In this case, the good news, of course, is that the rest of the bridge did not fail. What it does mean is that it may be very problematic, very challenging for WashDOT to simply replace that collapsed section and sort of make the entire bridge good for the long term. They well may have to look at replacing that entire bridge long term.
Meaning you can't, it's not just a matter of slicing a little piece out and putting a piece in, it was all integrated together?
Right. So if you've seen a picture of the bridge collapse, it looks like essentially a section of the concrete just fell into the river.
Right.
But that concrete was being supported by overhead pieces of mm-hmm. steel. And so what's happening is the rest of the bridge that did not collapse structurally is being supported in part by the section that has collapsed.
I see. According to WashDOT, this bridge was inspected a couple of times last year and was not put on something they call a watch list. So does that mean that there was no inherent, aside from its design, no inherent problem with it?
That's correct. It was classified as functionally obsolete. It's sort of a transportation insider term, which basically means it wasn't built to the standards that we build our bridges to today. In this particular case, that section of I-5, that bridge, the lanes are a lot more narrow than what we would prefer today, than what we would build today. And in fact, there are some truckers that have already been on social media some of the other media outlets who say, yeah, when we're approaching that bridge, the lanes get a little narrow and it gets a little, you know, scary for us when we're, and what we prefer to do is sort of straddle both lanes going through there. And so that can cause other drivers some discomfort, too. So it doesn't mean that it's inherently unsafe or that it's about to collapse or anything like that. It just means that it's not built to today's standards.
I noticed that WashDOT has a long list of what it calls structurally deficient bridges. There are dozens of them around the state.
There are, and within that classification structurally deficient, there's a secondary rating that helps us understand which of those bridges are in decent, good shape and which are in poor. So, for example, I believe that bridge had a sufficiency rating of 57 on a scale of 1 to 100, 100 being best, 1 being kind of dangerous. Mm-hmm. And to give you a point of reference, the viaduct has a sufficiency rating of 9, the viaduct.
Oh, my gosh.
SR-99 in Seattle, which is why we're currently replacing that bridge right now. So it's a little misleading when you look at the sheer number of structurally deficient bridges. Many of them are in pretty good shape. WashDOT has made a little bit of progress in reducing the number of bridges on that list. It went from about 390, I think, went from about 400 on that list in 2007 to about 390. They haven't knocked down the list very far for two reasons. One is more bridges are being added to the system, and we're sort of just marching in place when it comes to providing funds for fixing bridges.
I was just going to ask you, who pays to rebuild a bridge like this?
Well, ultimately, taxpayers. In this particular case, most of the funding is going to come from the federal government's USDOT Emergency Relief Fund. But, of course, the ultimate source of those kind of funds are gas taxes and related transportation fees on tires and licenses and things like that. So you can say the federal government, but in essence, taxpayers will pay for it.
You mentioned that the bulk of money comes from the federal government, but as I understand it, that those funds will only pay for a rebuild of the bridge as it was designed. It doesn't really allow for improvements?
I'm not sure about the technical details of that. There are quite a few restrictions that the federal government places on its emergency relief funds.
And how long would you imagine a rebuild would take? We're hearing weeks, but that seems awfully quick.
Well, a temporary rebuild, I think, could take weeks, possibly a few months. A long-term solution, if it's needed, if for example, they need to replace that bridge, that could take a year to 2 years. We've seen in similar instances the Minneapolis Bridge, a bridge down in the San Francisco area. When these bridges collapse, they tend to get rebuilt much more quickly than the time it takes to replace a bridge that that hasn't collapsed.
Huh. Well, Larry, thank you for taking time to join us this morning.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Larry Eel publishes and edits the website transportationissues.com. He's a former employee of Washington State Department of Transportation. I'm Marcy Silman. This is Weekday.
KUOW. It's 9:33.
Support for KUOW comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation. Knight Foundation promotes informed and engaged communities and helps NPR advance quality journalism in the digital age. More at knightfoundation.org.
We have 52 degrees with overcast conditions this morning in Seattle's U District. It's going to be mostly cloudy today. We're looking at about a 40% chance of some more showers. Expect a high today of about 59. It'll be cloudy tonight with some rain possible. We'll drop down to around 48. Tomorrow calls for mostly cloudy skies. There's a slight chance of some more rain tomorrow. We'll see a high of about 63. And it may clear up a little bit Sunday. We're expecting partly sunny skies, then maybe a little rain will be up around 68. We'll get a more in-depth look at our Memorial Day weekend forecast coming up at 9:55.
This week on This American Life, Starley and Robin were getting to be friends. But you know how it is. People are busy, so little time to talk, explain your past. So Robin switched to Plan B.
Okay.
She made Starley a tape.
What I'm going to do for you today is an ex-boyfriend montage. With
stories about Plan Bs of all sorts. Or is that Plans B, of all sorts, this week?
Like a buzzword, like sex.
Tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock on KUOW.
Support for KUOW comes from Laird Norton Wealth Management, celebrating 75 years of King County Parks by establishing the King County Parks Foundation, devoted to strengthening families and connecting communities for generations to come. Information on contributing at OurParksOurFuture.org.
I'm Rob Wood. The president spoke at the U.S. Naval Academy's commencement address this morning. We'll get details of what he said and the latest on last night's I-5 bridge collapse in Mount Vernon in the headlines. That's coming up at 10:01 here on 94.9 KUOW.
This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. The annual Northwest Folklife Festival kicks off today at Seattle Center. Over its four decades, folklife has been a place to listen to music, to dance, to eat giant waffles, and when the weather's good, to watch people in the around the fountain. Every year, festival organizers try to focus the spotlight on different communities in our region, and this year, labor is the centerpiece of the festival. Joining us with a folklife preview, Debbie Fant, who is Folklife's Deputy Director and Head of Programming, Connor Casey, a labor archivist for the Labor Archives of Washington, which is housed at the University of Washington, I believe, and with their instruments, musicians Brandon Vance and Mark Minkler. And Debbie, I want to start with you. Is there an overarching programming philosophy at Folklife?
Well, yeah, the overarching programming philosophy is to provide opportunities for people to share their traditions and their heritage, their music, their dance, their storytelling, the things they do at home. And that's one of the things we've been able to do for the past 42 years, I think, pretty successfully.
Do you have any idea how many cultural or ethnic communities actually participate at Folklife?
Well, we have communities, ethnic communities, and we have communities of affiliation, such as dance communities or choral communities, and we count over 70.
Over 70.
Over 70.
How long have you been with the festival?
This is my 10th.
10th year. So yeah. Do you see a lot of return musicians? Are you looking for new things all the time?
We see a lot of return people and we're looking for new people. And it's really gratifying because we have some old favorites like the Hawaiian community comes and performs every year. The Colors and Cultures of India performs. These big showcases. The Bulgarians are new. This year we have a new showcase. The Persians are coming for a showcase. So we try to have a balance between old and new, and we're always encouraging new people when we hear of something that's exciting. We encourage people to come and put in an application, let us hear what they've got, because lots of times it's cutting edge stuff that doesn't appear at other festivals till much later down the road.
So we've got Brandon Vance and Mark Minkler here with what I think of as traditional folk instruments, an acoustic guitar, a fiddle. You can call that a violin, depending on what genre. So I'm going to have you guys play a tune, and I have some questions about sort of the evolution of folk life. So you want to, I don't know if mm-hmm. you want to just hit it. Thank you. a little noodling at the end of that tune. That was Mark Minkler, guitar, fiddler Brandon Vance. Fiddler is the correct term.
Sure.
That sounded like a medley. I'm going to ask you, Brandon, since the mic is closest, maybe you want to pull that mic to your mouth. What was that you were playing?
This is an original composition, two tunes I wrote a while ago. First one's called Naljamboso, which is dedicated to my Korean step-grandmother, Sang-ae. And the second tune's called Enigma, and that's dedicated to her daughter, which is my aunt.
Aunt,
I guess. Yeah. Anyhow, I tend to write tunes for family.
For family, and then play them for a lot of listeners.
Exactly.
And just the two of you together playing at Folklife, or do you have more musicians playing with you?
Yeah, it'll just be the two of us.
It's just the two of us. Yeah, Brandon's doing some other shows with other people, but.
So this is the type of music, Debbie Fant, that I associate with the origins of Folklife, the sort of originally from Northern Europe, migrating across America kind of music. Mm-hmm. But I know it's been at least 30 years since the scope of the festival really was to go beyond what people think of as folk music.
Well, actually, the original festival, the first festival, represented just about every ethnic community that was here, including the Native American communities. Now we try and represent every community that lives in the region. It's a stretch. It's hard, but I think we do a pretty good job.
So one of the communities represented this year, I guess, is the labor community, Connor Casey, if you think of it as a community. Do you?
Absolutely. I think that one of the great things about labor being the focus this year, the cultural focus, is that labor history and culture really is a distinct unit, that we have such a rich labor history in this region. And, it evolved its own song, its own idioms, its own cultural practices. And I think you'll see that in some of the exhibits and the art and the panels and the different songs.
Yeah. I have to ask what the Labor Archives of Washington actually is.
Well, the Labor Archives of Washington was founded in 2010, and it was actually funded by the labor community, and it's a collaboration between the Harry Bridges Center for Labor Studies and the University of Washington Library Special Collections. And the idea was that it would be able to create deeper access and acknowledgement of the fact that there are already a couple thousand cubic feet of really rich labor collections there, but also I'd be able to work with the labor community to bring in and help preserve their records and work more directly so that we could bring in new collections and document that history.
A couple thousand cubic feet, is that how you guys measure an archive?
Yeah,
like
right.
how big it is?
It's basically a copy paper box full of stuff.
So what kind of stuff is in the archive?
Well, it's a range of stuff from minute books to correspondence to picket signs to IWW silent agitator wobbly stickerettes to photographs and oral histories. And increasingly, we're starting to take in born digital things, too.
I know that one of the things that people who come to Folklife will see is actually a labor visual art exhibition. It's a collection of prints.
Yes, this was a very serendipitous thing. Basically, within Special Collections, each curator gets a rotating spot for an exhibit. And right when my spot was coming up, Leslie Correll, who was the daughter of Richard Correll, who was an artist, contacted me about donating her father's entire surviving collection. And so we were able to do an exhibit around it. Richard Correll was an artist who spent the bulk of his life living in the on the West Coast, in Oregon and Washington and California. And he spent his career on Madison Avenue in New York. But his images, the ones that he did in his spare time, the ones that he really cared about, were those of social justice and civil rights and documenting the dignity of labor and also real people.
So how many, this whole collection, how big is it?
Well, I haven't fully processed it. I actually
that
put
big.
It on an exhibit before we got – so looks like it's going to be – depending on how we house it, I'd say about maybe 10 cubic feet.
So I'm cubic feet, as the musicians were making gestures with their hands. I have no idea what that really means. But Debbie Fant, how much of this Correll collection are we actually going to see at Folklife?
Well, up in the Lopez room, we have the whole end of the room, Connor's digitized a whole series of images that are amazing. They, longshoremen in the 1950s, workers, migrant workers, images that are reminiscent of WPA images, photographs, just, and they're striking. They're black and white images, they're lino cuts, and beautiful, beautiful, striking, graphic and moving images, and moving by the lines of them move. You know, it's
the lines move in our eyes.
In our eyes, they're just they're so visual and alive.
Connor Casey, you mentioned that we have a particularly rich labor history in this region. How do we compare to, you know, New York? There's, you know, garment workers on the East Coast. There's auto workers where I'm from, Detroit. I mean, what do we have here?
Well, right now, you know, Washington State still has one of the highest union densities of any state in the nation. 20% of the workforce is actually union. But the history is, it goes back to being the fact that there were comparative labor shortages because we were in the West. And some of the industries in which people worked were some of the most dangerous, the most extractive, the least buffered in terms of the differences between the workers and the people who were owning the company. So there are dramatic episodes, like many people are familiar with the, you know, 1919 Seattle General Strike. There's also the 1934 Coast Maritime Strike. And in these struggles, the workers basically worked to strive to support one another to get a bigger piece of the pie.
Well, it's interesting, Debbie Fant, that you would choose this year to focus on labor because despite the fact that Connor says 20% of our area workers are unionized, I think probably unionized workers would say that they're seeing an erosion in the benefits that they have, and everything from health insurance co-pays to actual salary grades and things like that. So what sorts of we're going to see this art, but the centerpiece is more than just something to look at. You've got a lot of panels.
The centerpiece is the narrative stage at SIFF Cinema, which, by the way, is sponsored by KUOW. We're so pleased that's the case. And, yeah, there's a whole series of people talking throughout the weekend about their work, their lives, what they do. We have a history of the Pacific Northwest to tell you exactly. So why is labor so important? What, you know, why are people excited about labor? And what's the history of this? We have clergy people coming in, two Protestant pastors and a rabbi to talk about their work. We have Fisher poets coming in. Rosie's. Some of the most exciting stuff. We've got Rosie the Riveters, who were the women who went to work during World War II in factory jobs and when the men went to war. And some of them are still alive that were Washington State Rosies.
You've also recorded some of these oral histories, correct?
That's right. That's right. We're working in Northwest Folklife is working in conjunction with the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress to do interviews with union workers all around the state of Washington. And that's an ongoing process for the next year or so. And it's the Archie Green Project.
Has Folklife endeavored something like this before?
Not the interviews, no, but every year we have a cultural focus, and every year we get to present a different group and work with a different group that has different traditions, and that's the amazing thing.
So, Mark and Brandon, I'm curious, how many years have each of you been going to Folklife?
Oh, my God.
42?
Probably about 35 years for me or something.
A little less than that for me.
Since he's only 28.
Yeah. About 10 years for me, I think.
So
it's a decade, yeah.
Do you look forward to something particular besides you yourselves playing? Anything that you look forward to seeing every year?
Oh, I just, I really love the just the variety of all the different things that you can do there, and the fact that it's there's always something for everyone, you know.
Over the many years that you've been going, what has surprised you the most? And is there a tip that you'd give to somebody who's not ever been to Folklife to find that hidden gem?
I'll just walk around, and there are a lot of stages, and there's things going on all the time, so.
So do you have another short tune for us?
Huh. I suppose. Elf, sure.
Nothing like putting musicians on the spot.
No, it's fine. We've got a tune that Mark wrote here.
Okay.
It's going to be on our new album coming out called The Way Forward.
The Way Forward. He has to readjust. This is live radio. Readjusting the microphones. Brandon Royce and Mark Minkler. Brandon Vance and Mark Minkler are going to be performing at Folklife, which starts today, runs through Memorial Day at the Seattle Center. Also with us has been Connor Casey, an archivist for the Labor Archive of Washington State, and Debbie Fant, Deputy Director for the Northwest Folklife Festival and Director of Programming. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Marcy.
Thank you.
This is Weekday on KUOW. And while they unpack, we're just going to get a forecast. It's been a cold, wet week. Nick Bond, state climatologist, what can we expect?
Well, today, some improvement. It's got to be better than the last few days in which we had some really chilly temperatures here in western Washington. And so today, there's a continuing chance of some rain showers, especially midday here. But then steady improvement through Sunday. Can't dismiss the chance of showers tomorrow and temperatures in the low 60s, but Sunday looks to be a dry day and maybe even high 60s. And then for Monday, it's a bit uncertain. There looks to be a weak system moving in mostly to the south of us. And so I'd say there's maybe a 50-50 chance of light rain developing in the afternoon and especially in the south part of the sound. But right there. We're just going to have to keep an eye on that one.
So, Nick, last week I recall that you mentioned we might see some cool weather, but it was super cold this week.
Yeah, and especially, we had a high temperature of 52 at SeaTac on Wednesday and just 49 in Olympia, and that's especially remarkable for Olympia. Both were record low max temperatures, over an inch of rain, so you won't have to water your slugs for a while or anything. And the inclement weather wasn't just in the Puget Sound region. In particular, the Yakima Valley got just drenching rains Tuesday night with almost 2 inches at one spot in just a few hours. And it was it was cold. In Bickleton, a small community in the Horse Heaven Hills. And isn't that about the most evocative name for a region you've ever heard?
It's a grape-growing region in our state. It snowed, didn't it?
Yeah, almost a foot of snow, I guess, at 3,000 feet. And the small school there had their only snow day of the year due to the snow-laden trees bringing down power lines.
But they were lucky that this weather hit now, right, because the fruit hadn't really set. We're not seeing any problems.
Right. The cherries in particular, as they get further along and getting close to ripe, they're really prone to cracking if they get rained upon. And so it's better now than just in a few weeks when the harvests really start cranking up.
But essentially, we're not looking for maybe a touch warmer than what we've seen, but not, you know, a great weekend of sunshine, basking type weather.
No, but again, Sunday should be a pretty nice day, and it can't eliminate completely the chance of some light rain, but I'd say 20% or less, and again, kind of high 60s, so not too bad.
Okay.
And then in the, you know, longer term, next weekend, midweek being a little bit on the cool, wet side, looks anywhere from not bad to quite nice. So, you know, don't give up hope.
Well, thank you. You have a good Memorial Day weekend, Nick.
You too. Thanks.
Thanks. Nick Bond is Washington State climatologist. He works at the Joint Institute for the Study of Atmosphere and Ocean. Sounds like at this point, Sunday is going to be your best bet. We're looking for temperatures in the 60s or so with a chance of rain for sure tomorrow, 20% Sunday. And as Nick says, it's all kind of unclear what's going to happen on Monday, Memorial Day. Coming up on Weekday, we talk more about the bridge collapse over the Skagit River on I-5 near Mount Vernon and look at the week's news with our panel of journalists on Weekday.
We'll get the latest on last night's I-5 bridge collapse in Mount Vernon in the headlines in just a minute. This is KUW.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.